Pushkin.
From Pushkin Industries, this is Deep Background, the show where we explore the stories behind the stories in the news. I'm Noah Feldman. In honor of the Academy Awards this weekend, we have an extra special episode for you about the movie Bombshell. Bombshell is based on the sexual harassment scandal at Fox News that brought down CEO Roger Ailes. The movie is up for several awards. Best Actress for Charlize Theron, Best Supporting Actress for Margot Robbie, and Best Makeup and Hairstyling. I got to speak to the screenwriter, Charles Randolph, about how the movie came into existence and about his views on the awards process in general and the complicated politics that surround them. Charles, thank you so much for being here. This is a thrill for me.
Gladly.
I want to start talking about the process that led you to write the screenplay for Bombshell.
Okay.
And take us back. You had just, maybe it was right when you had just won your Academy Award for Big Short, or maybe it was before that. What was the timing in relation to
that? Yeah, it was not long after, you know.
You're at the top of your career. You've just won an Academy Award, and you're thinking, what project do I do next? How did you gravitate to the Fox News harassment story?
Wow, what a good question. You know, it's a great story, right? The fact that a story of feminist determination came from these conservative women was really interesting and complicated. Mm-hmm. And what you're always looking for is you're looking for characters with strong internal conflicts. We think of a movie being made about your life as an award that Hollywood gives you, but that's not the case. We are always looking for stories where people have a rich and unusual, and you need both, internal conflict that will drive the story forward. And Megan and Gretchen both had that.
Megan Kelly, Gretchen Carlson, exactly. Everybody knows their names and first names are appropriate, but we should say it at least once.
Exactly. So that's what was the appeal. Like, this is a fascinating story with strong characters with strong conflicts. Also, I mean, I am a bit of a contrarian. So the idea that this moment, pre-Me Too moment, with such illustrative power in our society came from inside Fox News was sort of fascinating.
Although Me Too hadn't happened yet
when you
sat down to write this.
No, it hadn't.
We'll get to that more in a second.
Sure, okay.
But I just want to go back to this question of the conflicts.
Right.
I mean, to see the film is to believe you because you wrote them as characters with extraordinary conflicts. It's
right.
One of the reasons it's such a skillful script. But what conflicts did you see, as it were, before you started? I mean, when I hear that story, I don't think to myself, oh my goodness, this is maybe why I'm not a screenwriter.
Right.
What made you think there were conflicts there? Did you know in advance there had to have been conflict?
Megyn Kelly was quiet for 10 days. Why? Right? This thing happens. It's in everyone's interest to go out and say, Roger's fine. These things never happened, all that. But she was silent,
mm-hmm.
right? So what happened in that time? And that's where you start. You start with this thing of, that's really interesting. She was quiet. So you really are starting from that. You're starting from, there's a tell there.
Let me ask a follow-on question about the tell. One of the remarkable things that you do is you tell stories that are true stories,
right?
But you're still in some way fictionalizing them for the screen. And that's an incredibly delicate dance in its own way. It's much harder than doing pure truth documentary or pure made up fiction. It's just a higher degree of difficulty, as it were, on the dive.
Right.
So you imagined that those 10 days embodied a conflict.
Right.
And you made a movie where those 10 days do embody a conflict.
Yeah.
Would it matter to you if, in fact, the 10 days were, you know, she called her lawyers and they were like, let's see how this plays out. You know, we have a goal of getting more money at the end of the day. And if it didn't reflect some internal conflict, would that matter or wouldn't
it really
matter?
It would. You know, she's watched the film and she's come out and said that my portrayal of that internal conflict is too harsh in some ways against her because she was always a strong advocate of women. And we have one character accuse her in her silence of having, you know, perpetuated the culture of harassment. And then she reacts quite defensively in the film, you know, in that sort of classic Megyn Kelly way of saying, hey, that's how it is, snowflake kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the day, yeah, I want the conflict to reflect a real internal dynamic that's going on in that human being.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it did. She even says, you know, I have to say, I don't know if you saw the video of her watching the film.
Mm-hmm.
She says, you know, I have to say, I do feel like I could have done more. So while my expression of it didn't please her, the underlying fact of it, I think, was appropriate. And she admits that. And so, yeah, so I'm always hoping that those things that you arrive at, those internal emotional conflicts that you arrive at, that they're true and that they will resonate. Because if they are, this is a place where the truth will lead you to something that you can't really make up as effectively or efficiently. And so, you know, I always hope that, yes, that those portrayals, and it's true of Gretchen as well, reflect an underlying reality.
Is that because you think it's, as you said, more efficient from an artistic perspective? Or is it an ethical concern? I mean, I have in my mind the famous, maybe fictional exchange between Gertrude Stein and Picasso when, you know, she looks at his portrait of her and she sends him a note saying, it doesn't look like me.
Right.
And he sends her back a note saying, it will. So, I mean, you know, that's the case here. Right. Your depiction of this story is the one that everyone will remember.
Right.
Not just Megyn Kelly, but her children and her grandchildren and the whole world.
Right.
She herself will probably come to remember it in this way, because that's the power of a film like this, of a successful, widely viewed film.
Yeah, I take that responsibility very seriously. I do. Yeah. And it is largely an ethical concern to get it right. You know, there are things you have to cheat. You know, time frames get truncated for sure. Dialogue is invented without doubt. The emotional flavor of individual scenes changes. But I want the struggles that these human beings go through in this world to be as true as possible.
Let me ask you about, again, the background to that sort of remarkable video where you see Megyn Kelly responding to the film in which she is a character.
Right.
Very obviously, she did not know what was coming.
Yeah.
She had no say in your script.
None.
Technically, how does that happen? Is it that her story was sufficiently in the public domain that neither you nor the producers had to go to her to get any permission or any right to use her story?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the dominant part of the narrative, right? And the narrative is broader than just her story.
Sure.
So part of it's that. Part of it is she is a public figure who's, you know, influenced our culture in big ways, and our laws are structured to, you know, shield anyone who wants to comment on her presence, you know, in a way. So a lot of this is, you know, obviously fair use. So technically it's not a problem as long as you're being as truthful as possible. Also, we're using beats and moments that she's discussed a lot. She wrote a book about that also appeared in other media narratives. It's not, you know, and appeared prior to her book as well. So, and you know, obviously I'm talking to more than her. I'm interviewing, you know, 20 people at Fox. So some of these perspectives on scenes with her are from people who, you know, are in the room with her as opposed to coming from her directly.
So she's just pretty lucky that, you know, she gets a depiction that is, she may not have thought it was sufficiently sympathetic, but that is in certain respects sympathetic to her.
I mean, part of it, no, there's a bigger issue here, which is that film is inherently humanizing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the critique that a film about someone will normalize them, will platform them, is true. It does. It inherently does that.
The worst person depicted on film will somehow be comprehensible. And if to understand all isn't maybe to forgive all.
Yeah.
It's least to humanize.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So even someone like Roger gets humanized. And this is also, I remember, happening in the shadow of a hyper-partisan culture where so many of our narratives are being driven by media that with which have been Twitterized to the degree we have a strong emotional, you know, reaction to these human beings already. We think we know. And so contrasting that is not difficult, let's be clear, right? Because there's been such vilification of parties on both sides of the aisle, any kind of normal human discourse that's short of odious often feels very humanizing, you know, strangely enough.
That's assuming that it's short of odious.
Right.
But to go back to your ethical point, that also must be partly your choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
To humanize, because that makes it greater art.
Yeah. I'm a big believer that in this particular moment, especially, the you know, art complicates. So part of it is in the shadow of partisanship, any kind of portrayal of a real human being feels grounded and humanizing in a way.
And it seems particularly significant because that human is Roger Ailes, who is held responsible by so many people, rightly or wrongly, for our culture of vilification.
Yeah, exactly. That's the irony.
I mean, that really is. I mean, that's like irony with the bright red capital letters.
Absolutely, right. Yeah. So we are hopefully extending to Mr. Ailes something he didn't extend to the rest of the world, right? And that's okay because you know, I'm fully aware of the fact that I'm being empowered by a massive amount of money and a massive distribution network that will distribute my vision of these human beings around the planet. Mm-hmm. And so certainly that comes with an obligation to hopefully be as judicious and human as possible.
One thing about humanizing sexual harasser, though, which I think is actually underlooked in the public discourse around this, is of course we're all eager to condemn everyone who engages in sexual harassment right. as evil.
Right.
But if you think that it's only the most extreme evil people who engage in sexual harassment, then it's really hard to explain why there's so much of it out yeah. there in the world. And part of it is realizing that yeah. lots of people who don't think they're such terrible people and who might in other domains of their lives not be so terrible
yep.
could still do this.
Absolutely. So the guy twirling his mustache, you know, is not the one who's going to create the most emotional damage in a woman's life. It's the person she considers a friend who on the business trip suddenly, you know, says, hey, let's go to the hotel bar and then goes south from there. Or the man she considers a mentor. You know, those are the situations where you get the most in trouble. So with Roger, part of it was creating a portrait of him that allowed us to sympathize with him to the degree that those scenes could have real power.
You know, we reached the point in the conversation where, you know, two white guys are now talking about sexual harassment. Right. We can hear the little voice, you know, in our ears saying, what's wrong with this picture? And it won't be a sufficient answer to say, well, white guys do most of the sexual harassment, so why shouldn't we be the ones to speak about it in this contemporary era where we're all very focused and concerned appropriately yeah. on agency? It seems like a violation of agency for the two of us to sit here and talk about sexual harassment from the standpoint, as it were, of the harasser.
Right.
When there are human beings, women being harassed, and right. we want to have the agency to speak about this topic. So I just want to ask you for your thoughts of starting with the critique that simply says, you know, why you?
Yeah. Well, I wrote the script before the Me Too movement began in its most populist form. So prior to the Harvey Weinstein, I've actually finished about 2 months before the Harvey case broke.
That was fast work.
Yeah. So I wrote it over that, you know, just after the election, over that spring. So in a way, there was no one telling that story at the time. Had Harvey's situation occurred, I probably would not have written it. I probably mm-hmm. would not have sold it. I'd have probably thought, oh, this issue is getting enough traction that I don't have to. Mm-hmm. So part of it's just, you know, this feeling that no one was telling the story and it needed to be told.
And that's, by the way, something that the public just isn't that aware of. They see a film coming out now, a couple of years after Me Too, and they think, oh, this was a Me Too movie, not realizing it just takes a long time to put together a film like this.
It takes forever. I mean, contracts alone take 8 months, you know, plus legal vetting on a film like this. It just takes forever.
So part of your answer is, when you started doing it, there wasn't a Me Too.
Yeah, but that's, you know, that's a cop out. Mm-hmm. I think there's a you know, let's address the real problem is, should men be telling these stories? And I go back and forth myself, mm-hmm. right? Partly, yes, there, you know, I'm also writing men in these situations, and getting that right, getting that accurately mm-hmm. matters for helping us understand this. And certainly the other thing is, my greatest desire is to put men in those rooms, like the situation in the film between Margot Robbie's character, Kayla, mm-hmm. and Roger Ailes. Because if I can put men in those rooms, they can see how these situations are, A, extremely complicated, mm-hmm. And can be utterly life-changing. I have found in my own life a tendency, when these narratives pop up, to be a little dismissive in an almost instinctual way. It's almost as though, you know, the minute I hear one of these stories, I have this Darwinian thing to say, yeah, but you know, she went into that office, like I immediately have that thing that mm-hmm. comes up, that voice in my head, that masculine protective, that sort of gender defensiveness. And so I wanted to interrogate that part of myself. Mm-hmm. As I say, I wanted to drag my own prejudices through, you know, a gauntlet of real lives and sort of examine them. And so I hope that in showing those situations to men around the world, I am doing the greater good, and that I am willing to accept the critique that there probably is someone who could have told this story better, who is woman, mm-hmm. But you know, she had not yet emerged, and so I did what I could.
So it's interesting. There are sort of two strands.
Yeah.
One is the educative part.
Yeah.
And strand two, I thought, was the internal part, the part where every artist is, to some extent, grappling with his or her own internal voices and internal demons. And I think what you say is, I think it's true, surely, of the great majority of men, and very possibly of just about all men, that they will instinctively, even if their consciousness has been raised, identify with other men or want to deny the depth and extremity of, you know, what reality tells us. I mean, my version of that would be just time after time during the Me Too process saying, that guy, now that guy, you know, and just thinking to myself, at a certain point, I realized, you know, you know, Noah, you just don't know what men are capable of. You know, you just, you know, maybe you have your own superego has developed in a certain kind of way, you have a certain kind of guilt consciousness, but maybe not everybody's is, you know, but the point is just a recognition that I share that same kind of gender protective instinct. I think we have it. I think, though, that the left critique from a strong feminist would go after both of these things by saying, well, education is great, but couldn't you have picked another story to do it on? Or, you know, why does this have to be men educating men using the story of women as their instrument? And then on the personal thing, they would say, well, that's it. They accept that, they would accept that art always involves some self-exploration. But they'd want to see the film that would emerge if that self-exploration was from the woman's perspective rather than the men's. And then they would point to the industry and say, well, maybe no one had emerged, but maybe that's because women were denied the opportunity, you know, for their voices to emerge.
And they would be right on both counts in my book, And I would like to think that our film is moving the ball down the field, right? And that someone else can come along and say, okay, here's this film. It was made for 30. It's going to make, you know, what, 50, 60 million worldwide. So there is, you know, there's a door open there that we can prove that these stories, there's an audience for these stories. And so that, we are, you know, we are delicately laying the foundation for, you know, the quintessential Me Too movie to come along, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 years from now, totally done by women.
Right. And when someone writes the Harvey Weinstein biopic, it will be a woman.
Yeah. And I think the two people that are hired for that picture, I think their two projects are both women too, right? You know?
That makes sense. And so I was speaking abstractly, but but in real life, I guess that's already happening.
Plan B's got one, and I know there's another one out there too. And there's also a film, an indie film coming out about assistant in Harvey's life. So so there are other things coming for sure, you know? And it's, but it's a part of, you know, it's part of this broader conversation about how we are going to reach some version of parity behind the camera. And how can we do that as ruthlessly, efficiently, and quickly as possible? You see that playing out, you know, in the Oscar, you know, conversation right now. But you know, I'm more than willing to take whatever criticism comes by virtue of just wanting to do whatever we can to help the situation.
Were there other critiques beyond the gender identity one that struck you as meaningful ones?
Well, what we get a lot of is frustration that the film does not take Megan to task more for her complicity in the broader culture. At Fox, right? That's a little difficult because what I wanted to avoid was making it sound as though right-wing ideology creates necessarily a context for harassment, because we know that's not true. This is happening in every office around the country. I think really at the end of the day, a lot of people wanted the race issue to be addressed. And I struggle with this. You know, I had early drafts where, you know, I tried to address it. There's a, you know, sort of a famous bookkeeping office where things got pretty dark over at Fox, and there were a couple lawsuits of race-based harassment. I tried to have Roger walk into one of them at one point, you know, all this. And it just, it never worked. It felt like we were undermining the issue of harassment itself. Until I came up with this thing I was convinced was genius. Here's how I was going to solve this problem. 4, 5, 6 times in the film, an African-American individual would wander in frame and they would see the camera. They would have sort of privileged gaze of the sort of context of production, so to speak, and they go, oh, sorry, and back out, right? And so the idea was that anytime an African-American person was introduced into the frame, they would be, sorry, and just leave the frame, right? To suggest that this is subtly and comedically a, not very subtly, comedically, a environment absolutely hostile to that perspective. Now, in saying that, you already know what I discovered in the editing room with Jay, which is this was a very bad idea.
Because it made it look like they were saying that the movie was a white people's movie rather than that Fox News was a white people's environment.
A, it was hard to read the intent, but the fact you're asking the audience to read the intent of the moment already suggests problems, right? You know?
Right.
And it was one of those things that was either confusing or just, it just felt like it was the disease it purported to cure, you know?
Yes.
And so at the end of the day, both the structural things I tried to do to address race at Fox and the playful things I tried to do just didn't work.
Right.
So that's, you know, you do what you can. Thankfully, it's a, you know, it's a medium that's, it's slow, but we have the ability to correct our mistakes. And we just took that out and, you know, now you can, as critics do, complain about their not addressing the race issue.
So you mentioned the Oscar context,
right?
And I think that's a great topic to talk about here. Is there a revenge or reaction or blowback moment coming from the men in the Oscar nomination process?
I think you're seeing that now, right? I think this season is very male-driven, with a lot of films addressing sort of male identity and revisiting male identity. And part of that, I think, is the fact that a certain core group of filmmakers who obviously make movies about strongly male issues are making their films. But yeah, I think we're at a little bit of a broader cultural blowback against Me Too. And I think the film season this year reflects that in some ways. Yeah.
I want to talk about some concrete cases.
Sure,
like, why didn't Greta Gerwig get nominated for Best Director for Little Women? I mean, I thought that Little Women was a terrific movie. But more importantly, I perceived, maybe wrongly, that what made it distinctive and different from all the other Little Women's that are out there was the kind of direct hand of the director. Yeah. You know, the sense that the director had a vision, was going a certain way. The presentation was distinctive. The outcomes were distinctive. And I was genuinely surprised in my ignorance that it didn't yield a Best Director nomination. Explain to me what I'm missing, because I think I am missing something, several things.
Well, those of us in the industry were not as surprised, because it had not won any of the precursor awards that you normally get. I think the broader, most interesting thing for me to say about this stuff is we are in the Academy attempting to reach gender parity and to some degree inclusion on a level of ethnicity. But that is coming with greater internationalization.
Explain that.
So that
sounds really interesting.
So that, for example, in the director's branch, the people we are inviting, the women we are inviting in
to join the Academy,
tend to
and therefore
be,
to vote.
Exactly. Tend to be international. I think with a film like Greta's, what ended up happening is that international cohort probably did not respond to the film as powerfully as you did. Because it is very American. It's a very American story.
Sure.
You know, and it has...
Classic American tale. Yeah.
And it has a kind of Christmas morning cheeriness to a lot of the scenes that I think for...
Literally.
Yes. for some, you know, for some directors outside of this country, seems just very American, you know? So there's that. And that's a situation in which I think that internationalization maybe worked against a film. But I think in terms of the performances, it helped. So SAG, for example, did not nominate any of
Screen Actors Guild.
Yeah, Screen Actors Guild for their awards did not nominate any of the women from for Ensemble. And I don't think for any of the individual awards either. However, the acting branch of the Academy did. So that group felt those performances were worthy of recognition in a way that the more exclusively American group, which, you know, so what SAG does is they have a committee of people that sort of, I think it's by lottery, that nominate. So you know, there are going to be good and bad things that come with that. On the whole, of course, it's great that we're becoming an international academy.
What aspect of your experience, both in writing your film, writing Bombshell, and also in pitching it to the world and talking about it, do you wish someone had asked you to speak about that no one has asked you about, if any? Maybe every question's been asked and you've said everything you want to say, but is there something that hasn't been asked or that you would like to say about it?
I mean, I think the thing that's gone under-theorized is how we are going to deal with the fact that men, particularly older men, but men in the Academy and in the filmmaking business have risen on the power of believing in their taste. believing mm-hmm. that their gut instinct matters. Mm-hmm. And you see this in Stephen King's recent tweet about the fact that he doesn't use diversity when making artistic evaluations and judgments about excellence, right? And he got beat up for that.
And he's, in a sense, the ultimate model
Absolutely.
Of a person who's, whatever his instincts are, somebody is buying them, right?
Absolutely.
I saw recently a list of American authors and how many books are purchased, might have been worldwide authors. And he was just towering
yeah.
over people who sell millions of copies.
Yeah.
He towered over all yeah. of them. Anyway, so go on.
So he's got that well-honed instinct, which he privileges as part of his core, part of his identity, mm-hmm. right? Now we want to come along and say, unfortunately, that instinct, it's not misogynistic. I think it's wrong when we use that phrase. It's mm-hmm. more, you know, androcentric, I suppose, is the word I'm looking for. It's sort mm-hmm. of male-centered. But we have to get people like that to engage with the idea that diversity doesn't mean necessarily throwing out, you know, that gut, but rather just doing a series of checks. And we've got to find a way to just somehow to introduce diversity and the discussion around diversity without this sort of naming and shaming mm-hmm. and really get people to think through, okay, here's a film like Little Women. Yes, that beautiful scene where someone talks about, you know, I'm so sick of being women being defined for who they love, yet I want love. It's like a
right.
beautiful, beautiful moment, right? That's not going to resonate with a lot of guys. Mm-hmm. But we have to get them in a position where they can see its power, mm-hmm. right? And I just feel like we do not have a good way to do that yet. One of the things I think we could do, which would help, is we could expand the best director category from 5 films to 10 films. Mm-hmm. And by the way that ranked voting works, that would inherently be more inclusive.
And since that's already been done in the past for other categories,
exactly.
right? It was done for Best Picture.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seems like a no-brainer.
Yeah.
What's so interesting about the example of the awards is that the awards are symbolic. And if they were yeah. only symbolic, yeah. we wouldn't spend so much time worrying about them. But as I understand it, in your industry, winning those awards translates
yeah.
into people sitting in the seat in the movie theater, which therefore translates into money. So winning the awards is actually a crucial component of how power gets deployed.
Absolutely.
And in that sense, it's super different
absolutely.
From the way awards work in many other domains of life.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And to answer your question is, I feel like the one conversation I'm not hearing as I've done the press for this film is a more honest conversation about gender politics and how gender politics influence our choices and how we can sort of arrive at solutions. I feel like what I'm getting a lot of is people wanting to evoke the problem, wanting to say this, but no one really wanting to kind of go through not enough people wanting to go through and have a candid conversation about what's possible and what's not possible.
Well, thank you for having that candid conversation with me. I'm really grateful to you for bringing this perspective. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Deep Background is brought to you by Pushkin Industries. Our producer is Lydia Jean Cott, with studio recording by Joseph Fridman and mastering by Jason Gambrell and Jason Rostkowski. Our showrunner is Sophie McKibben. Our theme music is composed by Luis Guerra. Special thanks to the Pushkin Brass, Malcolm Gladwell, Jacob Weisberg, and Mia Lobel. I'm Noah Feldman. You can follow me on Twitter @NoahRFeldman. This is Deep Background.